Today we're going to be talking about Chapter 3, Section 1. And we're looking at the political principles and major events that shaped how people form governments. Now, a few major terms that you're going to see are Constitution. That's the obvious one, right? It's a formal charter establishing the framework of our country. You'll see bicameral, confederation, ratify, and I'll try to give you those in context as we go through. You're also going to see a few operational words like convert, area, impact. I'll try to give us a good context for. So a government's got to start somewhere. And, historically, peaceful transitions of power were a rarity until the beginning of the United States government. You know, when the election of 2016 and all its drama occurred, and for better or worse, a new president assumed power. I think it's significant to note that the former president stepped down peacefully. The two obviously did not like each other. There are plenty of grievances both had against one another. But nonetheless, they respected the Constitution, and one stepped down, and the other assumed power. And, and that takes a lot of accountability. Because you can think also in history where that has not occurred. Say the story of Julius Caesar assumed emergency powers to put down a civil war. And when it was time to relinquish those powers, he refused. And he was murdered by the Senate. Appointed successor assumed power through yet another civil war and eventually rose to power and declared himself emperor. And so how do you organize a government? Well, hopefully not through the massive bloodshed that we've seen in history. Hopefully careful planning. And so as we start to think about the first independent state governments, that's really where these things began. We had no form of national government until, right before the Revolutionary War, we had the First and Second Continental Congress. And that was the closest that we had to any type of colonial national government. So if we really want to look at the beginnings of government in the United States, we have to look to the colonies and the states. So, when the colonies organized as states, they wrote constitutions. And by that, I just mean a detailed written plan for government. And I think, one of the interesting notes here is that none of these constitutions were perfect the first time around. All of these constitutions, including the United States one, leaves room for additions or subtractions. And so things can be changed, things can be overturned. But most of these state constitutions specified a bicameral legislature. And that means it has two parts or houses. So Tom Tillis is your United States Senator, representing half of North Carolina. Mark Meadows is your United States House of Representatives, representing us and several other counties. And so it's important to note that while Tom Tillis represents half the state, he and one other individual, each state has two votes. And then, and that's regardless of the state's size and population. But then, in regards to the House of Representatives, it goes by populations. We'll talk about that more later. But all of the states Constitution's provided for a governor elected by the people of the state and judges and courts. Okay. Now, most of these state constitutions are based around the ideas of the Declaration of Independence, the equality of all, and the idea that a government should not be able to tax its people without providing those people a say in the government. All of the state constitutions, just like the United States one, included a Bill of Rights. The North Carolina Constitution includes a Bill of Rights that guarantees certain basic freedoms and legal protections. They're outlined clearly, and so a big part of this class is teaching you your rights that you have from the government. The government has limitations in how they can deal with you, and that is important. And so you're going to learn those throughout this course. And so, you know, what is the most important thing the Constitution provides? You know, part of this is dealing with a framework, governor, legislature, court system, etc. But then also you have to think, what's the most important to you? I mean, the framework of the government is designed to be representative, and so that's A, B, and D. But then C there is the Bill of Rights, you know, your freedoms from the government. So which is more important? It's a matter of preference. Now, you probably already know or may remember from American history that America 1.0 was a major failure. The Articles of Confederation was a major failure. And we'll get into some of the weaknesses of this. And so, like Lauren was mentioning, the early American government was all based around the idea of protecting us from governments. The Anti-Federalists were very skeptical of any type of national government. And so the Articles of Confederation, and Confederation just means a group of individuals or state governments, loosely aligned. So a lot like the European Union. Germany is a nation. France is a nation. Both are a part of the European Union. They do work and collaborate on certain matters, but for the most part, they do their own thing. And so they are a confederation. So the Articles established a League of Friendship among states. We were essentially a collection of independent countries. Now, the Articles were ratified by all 13 states. Ratified just means it was approved by vote. And the Articles set up a one-house legislature called the Confederation Congress. It was very simple. Every state had one vote. And for anything serious to be done, all the states had to agree. Now here's the really tricky part. The Articles of Confederation could approve laws. The Confederation Congress could approve laws, but it would be up to the individual states to enforce them. And so this had a lot of inherent flaws. The Confederation Congress did not even have the power to tax the states. There were a few things they did manage to accomplish, like the Ordinance of 1785, which set up a system for surveying and selling land, because immediately after the Revolution, one of the big things that we were doing was growing, and that people were moving out into the frontiers, and so that was one of the few things that the actual Articles of Confederation did establish. In fact, the system works, and it's still in use today. Another of the accomplishments was the Northwest Ordinance, and it provided a way for territories to organize and become states. It's also important to note that even from the very beginning of our country, slavery was being regulated and outlawed in certain places. But of course, there were many weaknesses in the Confederation. that are worth pointing out. For a law to be passed, 9 of the 13 states would have to agree. A supermajority. To change anything in the Articles of Confederation, all states would have to agree. You know, and we've talked how hard it would be to get all of us in this room to agree on anything, much less anything of importance. And this is a major weakness. So, the Confederation Congress did not have the power to tax. They didn't have power to enforce their laws. So really, all they are, I mean, it's kind of like a United Nations, if you will. They can come together, they can make agreements, they can pass laws, but it's up to each individual state to enforce those. And so since Congress was unable to enforce the law, we run into a lot of problems. You see, I know you guys were young when Saddam Hussein was captured and hung, but he had been in violation of international law in Iraq for quite some time. He had used chemical weapons on his own people, the Kurdish people to the north of Iraq. He had, allegedly was building weapons of mass destruction. That turned out to no evidence that was found, but he was suspected of it. And so the hurting his own people with chemical weapons is a violation of international law. And the United Nations passed a condemnation of his actions. You know, so the United Nations all came together and they said, this guy's doing the bad thing. And we all know he's doing the bad thing. But here's the problem with the United Nations. They said, he's doing the bad thing, but we can't do anything about it. And so the United States stepped in and said, we're going to stop him from doing the bad thing. But we had to, it's up to those individual nations to do something about it. And so, again, several inherent problems. Number one, we wouldn't have been able to fight the Revolutionary War without help from other nations. France and Spain loaned us money and supplies to fight the war. But the trouble with a loan, it's not a gift, it's a loan. And so we had debt. Like, from the very beginning of our country's history, we had debt. And so the Confederation Congress needed a way to raise those funds. And so we were going to try to levy a tax on the people. And a man named Daniel Shays attacked a federal arsenal because he didn't want to have to pay taxes. He and his compatriots felt that the debt due by their state was causing their taxes to be too high, and so they led an armed attack on a federal arsenal. They didn't overthrow the government, but it sent a powerful message that, oh my gosh, if a bunch of angry farmers can just about overthrow a state government simply because they don't want to pay a tax, then we're going to have to figure out a way to be able to collect taxes and enforce laws. And so Shays' rebellion, even though like he wasn't trying to overthrow the entire national government, it sent a powerful message. And people began to think, maybe we do need a stronger national government. So ultimately, the Articles of Confederation were too weak. It's all based around that anti-federalist idea that strong national governments become tyrannical by default. But unfortunately, in practice, the Confederation proved too weak to survive. Today we'll be talking about Chapter 3, Section 2, and once more the big idea is how political principles and major events shape how people form governments. Because what we need to realize is you got to put that document in context. The Constitution's wonderful. It's no accident that it came about in 1789. Ironically, around the same time that the French Revolution was occurring. So our founding fathers are heatedly debating the essence of federalism while the French Parisians are storming the Bastille and ripping soldiers' body parts off and tossing them around the crowd. I mean, it's crazy to think of what's going on at the same time in different parts of the world. So some of the concepts that we'll see, we'll get to the Electoral College, we'll get to the Federalist, the Anti-Federalist, and lots of stuff to unpack for you. So a few terms that we'll just kind of operate off of, like process and despise. But the trick and the trouble, like a lot of you guys mentioned, is when we're dealing with a subject that people are passionate about, compromise is difficult. When we're dealing with a lot of people, there has to be a lot of compromise. The fewer the people, the greater the freedom. The bigger the representation, the greater the compromise. Because with the diversity of opinions, you've got to incorporate those as best you can into a simple document, which is not simple. And so, as the American leaders form this new government, Congress asked each state. So this is the Articles of Confederation, the Confederation Congress. They realized it was a failure, and so they came together. Each state sent delegates to try to figure out a better solution. You know, the first time they tried to tax people, farmers were burning villages and seizing federal buildings. This is not good. If they can't tax people, they can't be a government. If they can't be a government, then what are we? And so Congress asked each state to send representatives to Philadelphia, which was the operating capital at the time, to fix the problems within the Articles of Confederation. This began in 1787. It took approximately 2 years to have the details. So who were these delegates? There were 55 of them in total. A couple notables, Ben Franklin was there, George Washington, James Madison, both future presidents were there were some notables not in attendance. For example, Thomas Jefferson was in Paris. He was closely allied with Paris, and they were undergoing some rather significant political troubles. I mean, the king's about to get his head cut off, so he's over there as a diplomat trying to help sort things. John Adams was in London. Most of the Federalists were closely allied with Britain, and so he had close ties to London. Patrick Henry, remember the give me liberty, give me death guy, he just hated the whole idea. When he meant liberty, he wasn't talking about some kind of balance of power between state and federal. He just meant, no, get away from me, government. I'm going to go over here and farm. Yeah, just stay off my land. That was Patrick Henry. Now, there are some very important decisions that were made by these people. George Washington presided over this. I mean, most paintings of American history classes, most American history classes generally have some painting somewhere. I used to have one forever of Washington presiding over this. If you go to the Capitol, you'll see it. Each state got one vote, and they decided to keep it simple this time. A simple majority would decide any given issue. All this work was kept secret. Because just like we were talking about, if we open up this dialogue to more people, everybody has an opinion. Think of Parks and Rec. Every time they hold a town hall meeting, there's always the idiot with the question. Yeah, these guys, the 55 delegates, were trying to keep the idiots with the questions out of the room. The fewer the people, the fewer the questions, and the quicker this can go. Now, in the end, this was called the Constitutional Convention because this was a meeting of state delegates, and the ultimate purpose was to create a constitution. That is, a working framework for this group. Our student government has a constitution. If you've never seen it, it's on our school's website, I think. And when I first created it, I passed it around. I had a time for objections, for comment. I opened it up for public dialogue. when we were all good with it, we signed it. And then it's done. I need to do that again because every few years it needs to be revised because it's a living document. And that's how constitutions work. Now, they decided for a simple majority, possibly just because it made the process easier. The Constitution cannot be easily changed because it takes a two-thirds majority of Congress to change the Constitution, meaning it takes not just a majority of the states, it takes a supermajority. It makes it difficult to change. And so perhaps to streamline it, they just chose the simple majority. Now, what did it look like? It was the result of a series of major compromises. Now, these debates went on for 2 years, and you can read about the proceedings if you choose to later, but I'm going to keep it simple and summarize. A couple of the big compromises. Number one, the Virginia Plan. This called for a government very similar to the one we have today with a two-house Congress, representation in the two houses. Would be based on each state's population. So a bicameral legislature, a House and a Senate. But the key difference between the Virginia Plan and today's system is they wanted both houses to be based on the state's representation and would be reapportioned every 10 years according to the census. Which is how our U.S. House of Representatives works. You know, if North Carolina's population doubles in the next 10 years, then we will get more representatives in Congress at the next Senate, and they will be taken from some other state whose population has shrunk. Obviously, we have a different plan. That's how part of our Congress works. But you see, the Virginia Plan was incorporated with the New Jersey Plan. The New Jersey Plan called for a one-house legislature. This is the opposite extreme. Each state would get one vote, no matter how big or small they were. The small states loved this idea, obviously, because it effectively gave them more power. States didn't like this, for good reason. And so the great compromise was the formal agreement proposing a dual system of congressional representation. So we have both. North Carolina has two senators. Montana, a state as big as some countries, has two senators. Alaska, bigger than the entire southeastern United States. Two senators. It's crazy, right? Meanwhile, in the U.S. House of Representatives, California has like 30-something representatives. We've got, I can't remember, 9, somewhere around there, maybe 12, depends on the year. And so the Great Compromise provided for this bicameral legislature. This means that states would have equal representation in the House based on population, and then states would have 2 votes per state in the Senate. And that for any law to be passed, it would have to pass both houses, that is, the House and the Senate, and then it would have to go to the President's desk for signature. Or if he vetoes it, then they have to override the veto. So, it's known as the Great Compromise. That's a big part of it. You guys were asking about the 3/5 compromise. This was an agreement providing that slaves would count as 3/5 of a person in determining representation in Congress. And you're absolutely right that it's a dehumanizing view of human beings. But that's not how Virginia was concerned with it. Virginia wanted the three-fifths compromise because they wanted their slaves to count in regards to population because they wanted more congressmen. Ergo, more power in passing laws. Virginia and Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina didn't want slavery to end. And even in the framing of the Constitution, they pushed for the right to maintain legislative power to preserve their system of slavery. And that's the three-fifths compromise. Meanwhile, Congress would have the authority to regulate trade between states. Ironically, this is something the Articles of Confederation did not provide for. But interstate commerce regulation is one of the fundamental roles of the United States government. In the Constitution, or in the Constitutional Convention, it was agreed that the United States would not interfere whatsoever in the slave trade. Until 1808, it would be revisited. Now, the slave trade was abolished decades before the 13th Amendment was passed. Because that is the Portuguese slave traders that would bring the boats over and hold auctions for slaves. That was viewed as distasteful, even before slavery went out of fashion. I also want to talk about the Electoral College briefly. And I'm sure you guys have some experience with this. The Electoral College are the group of people named by each state legislature to select the president and the vice president. And so you all know in 2016 that 3 million people more voted for the person who lost than the person who won. If you didn't know that, by the way. The sitting president lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. But yet, they won the office of the presidency because of the Electoral College. And so this has led to a lot of questions about what is the Electoral College? Why is this a thing? And then after the election, I Googled it, and there have been other cases of this. Several of them. Perhaps the most famous, well, 16 might be the most famous now, but there have been several other notable cases throughout American history. So now we got to think about the different views when writing the Constitution. It was not an easy task. You know, for one, to sign off on the Constitution required 2 years worth of going, okay, two-house legislature. Is this going to work for you guys? Is this going to work for you guys? Okay, three-fifths compromise. Is this going to work for you guys? Is this going to work for you guys? I get South Carolina. I get that you're about to start killing people over the slavery thing. I get it. What if we count three-fifths of your slaves as population, and we promise not to touch slavery or even talk about it? Can we live with that? And South Carolina's like, all right, but you touch it. You know, and in all seriousness, it was South Carolina that started the Civil War. It was South Carolina that sent John C. Calhoun that came up with the nullification theory, blah, 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 blah. And you had a whole course about that. Various factions interpreted the Constitution very differently. For example, the Federalists were supporters of the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton was a big believer in the Constitution. He said, look, there needs to be an effective balance of power between the states and the federal government, but we still need an operating national government with real legitimate power. Otherwise, we can't call ourselves a country. Because what happens when one state does something bad to another state, because it will happen. And it has. And not just once, but many times, where representatives from one state have done something bad to representatives from a different state. Oh yeah, multiple times. Somebody's got to step in and resolve those disagreements. Ergo, Hamilton's argument was we need an effective national government or we don't have a government at all. And so Federalists supported dividing this power between states and federal governments, which is where we get the 10th Amendment, the catch-all that if we didn't say it in the U.S. Constitution, it's up to the states. And so they support the Constitution as it was written. Well, here's the thing. The original draft of the Constitution did not include the Bill of Rights. Honestly, the Federalists just kind of assumed, well, okay, we'll just assume that people have those rights. It's common sense, right? Well, the Anti-Federalists weren't that trusting. They were like, no, I want it in formal writing on the formal charter of our country that I can call you a doo-doo head if I want to. That my free speech allows me to criticize you if I don't like what you're doing. Because, of course, next you have the Anti-Federalists. And these were those who opposed the ratification of the Constitution. These were the famous holdouts. And like some of you said, represented significant chunks of this country. Wound up forming the first opposition political party. When Washington ran, there was one party, the Federalist. But it didn't take long for Jefferson to found his own party. And so the Anti-Federalists were famous holdouts. They opposed and distrusted any type of central or national government. They believed it gave too much power to the national government and took away too much power from the states. It's ironic, though, because our government today is so much larger and more complex than it was at the time of the founding of the Constitution. Do you know that when Jefferson took office as our third president, he eliminated taxes? He was able to run the entire United States government off of sales taxes from international trade. It's insane. And here we are. I paid a tax to drive my car here this morning. You know, a wheel tax. I paid a tax to fill up my car with gas the other day. You know, I paid a tax to exist in my house, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas Jefferson, you know, that's just, we're talking about the size of the government. And so imagine what type of heart attack the Anti-Federalists would have today, you know, in terms of thinking about the size and power of our national government. You know, even though today one party thinks of themselves as the little government party, one party thinks of themselves as the big party, I mean, what are we even talking about? Because we're never going back to no taxes. I mean, just forget about it. So, what do we even mean by small government anymore? But they did want a Bill of Rights, you know, and that's kind of the famous compromise that occurred from this debate. You know, they wanted that amendment that says, if we didn't think of it, it doesn't mean it still exists. You know, in legal terms, we'll learn when we get to the law portion of this course, it doesn't mean there's such a thing as an ex post facto law. You know, if you've ever had your parents say, I know I didn't tell you this, but you still shouldn't do it. In our country, that's illegal. And that's what the 10th Amendment is all about. If we didn't say it, if we haven't added it yet to the Constitution, live your life. Okay, so the Bill of Rights... Yeah, the Bill of Rights were added, obviously, and we'll learn about those details on a later date. The Constitution was ratified. Thank goodness we can have a country.
Amen.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yay, with a question mark. Okay. Do we need a strong national government? Section 3, and it's called the structure of our Constitution, and we're really dealing off this big idea once more, that a constitution, or a contract rather, reflects the values and goals of a society that creates it. Importantly, the preamble. The articles establish the branches of government, which are the legislative, executive, and judicial, and then the amendments list our freedoms from the government. And so those are the three main parts of the Constitution that we'll get into today. And while many of you guys did mention the importance of the adaptability of the Constitution, we should also realize it's not a simple thing. That even the passage of the 13th Amendment, ending slavery, was still a highly controversial decision. Even when it was just the northern states trying to figure out whether they should end slavery. And then, of course, the passage of all of these amendments, the 14th, the 15th, were rife with drama. And so it has never been easy to add or change an amendment to the Constitution. Which is why there's really good stories behind these amendments, too. Because it is a process to get them in there. Now, the Constitution is a remarkable document. You know, I hope you keep the one I gave you. I think it's worth holding on to. It's an adaptable, but it is also a foundational blueprint for our country. It has three parts. The preamble, which is the opening section of the Constitution. And I've cited it here for you. It says, and I quote, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish the Constitution for the United States of America." And so the preamble famously lays out the six chief functions of government: justice, tranquility, defense, welfare, liberty to ourselves and our posterity. The first one, of course, is our union. So it establishes the principle that the power of the government comes from the people. As Lincoln famously said, that our government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. And so once more, it goes over the six purposes of government. Secondly, you know, if the preamble serves as kind of a beautiful summary, the articles are where we begin to dig into the details. So, the first article is all about the legislative branch. That is the group that makes laws. It outlines the duties of Congress in making laws. How is a law made? And we'll watch the little Schoolhouse Rock video at some point of how a bill becomes a law. You know, it might start with an idea from Vaughn, and he might talk to Congressman Meadows. Meadows might like the idea. He might poll some people. He might gauge interest and realize this is something that everybody wants. Okay, he's going to push for it. He's going to take it to the House of Representatives. He's going to present it in the committee that he works in. If it passes committee, it's going to go to the floor. If it goes to the floor, gets a vote, goes to the Senate. Goes to the Senate, goes through committee, goes to the floor. Finally, the president signs it. Poof! Vaughn just came up with an idea that became a law. Now, that process might take years, but it can still happen. And all that's outlined in Article 1 of the Constitution. Article 2 establishes the executive branch. This is the group that carries out the laws. Not only does Vaughn get to have a hand in making the law, at least presenting the idea and pushing for it and promoting it, he might even get a hand in carrying out the law. No, it's not his job to carry out the law unless he goes into law enforcement, sure. But he gets to vote for the president. He can write in whoever he wants. I mean, sky's the limit. You know, he's likely to choose one of the popular candidates as they try to form a coalition, meeting a diverse group of interest. And usually one of the two candidates are going to meet enough of his interest to sway his vote. But ultimately, it's going to be the job of that president to carry out and enforce the laws made by Congress, again, as laid out in Article 2. This also explains how leaders can be elected, you know, all the fun Electoral College stuff and the rigmarole of the campaign process. But it also details how they can be removed if necessary. And that is, you know, you may have heard the phrase, Congress has approved the article of impeachment. That word article there is a specific reference to Article 2 of the Constitution. Article 3, as you might have guessed, establishes the judicial branch. This is the group that interprets laws. They interpret the law. So, for example, Arkansas passed a law saying that a religious image can be placed in a public building. And so, you know, Christian groups provided funding to place the Ten Commandments in the Arkansas courthouse. Well, another group interpreted the same law to say, if one religion can do their thing, we're going to do our thing. And they put up their statue. And now there's a big fight. Well, it's unlikely to go to the United States Supreme Court because it's a pretty obvious one. You pass a law like that, it's likely to be shot down in the state Supreme Court. Although it could, and other similar cases have gone to the United States Supreme Court because the Supreme Court deals with issues on a fundamental constitutional level. It's their job to interpret these laws. Because we all know what freedom of expression means. But how does it play out? How should that be interpreted? And so it lists the powers of the court system. Now, the next couple articles, or the next three, establish the relationship between the state and the national government. You know, your Federalist ads that I'm excited to see have a lot to do, ironically, with these three articles. They also tell how the Constitution can be changed if necessary, but ultimately, the Constitution is, quote, the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land. There is no higher power. We are a constitutional government. Our president is subject to the Constitution, as is all of our elected officials. There are limits to what the president may do, and those limits are laid out in the United States Constitution. You know, for example, you may have recently heard that the president was threatening to block individuals on Twitter who were getting on there to troll and criticize him. Did you know that the United States Supreme Court ruled that he can't block people on Twitter?
That's
great. True story.
Oh my gosh.
Why? Because it's a public forum. He's using public funds and resources to keep that forum open. You can't censor free speech. I mean, now granted, you have the right to block someone, you know, like, you know, someone's posting offensive stuff on your page, sure. You have that right. But he is a public official facilitating a public forum does not actually have the right to block people for criticizing him. Now, if you get on there and put offensive stuff, I imagine that's the same as if someone were putting offensive stuff on your page. I mean, I guess. But if you just get on there to say, I don't like what you're doing, Mr. President, and here's why, he does not have the right to censor that. So the Constitution ultimately is not just a framework for our nation. It is. It's operational. I mean, we use it, we cite it all the time. But it's also symbolic in that we are a constitutional democracy. And speaking of adaptability, it can be changed. It can adapt. However, that is not a simple process. For one, throughout the entire history of our country, 1789 to the present, we don't count the Dark Ages, but the 1789 to the present, there have been 27 amendments, and that is a change in the Constitution. And these amendments safeguard our freedoms. Of course, the one we talk about the most is the first, our civil liberties. And these are our freedoms from government. But there is obviously a process for amending the Constitution. It can be proposed by a national convention. And this is, I think, unique. It's interesting. It's worth noting. Let's say that there needs to be a constitutional change that we can't get Congress behind for some reason. We as a people can start a national convention. But the usual process is congressional action. You know, once more, Dakota says, hey, I think we should all wear green shirts to school on Mondays. It should be a national thing. Awesome. He proposes it. Meadows is on board. He convinces his colleagues to get on board. And by 3/4 of the states, again, not a simple thing, but 3/4 of the states are on board with green shirts on Mondays. Sweet. Signature of the president, we're good to go. Secondly, interpretation of the Constitution. Implied powers are powers that Congress does not specifically have, but the Constitution suggests that these powers do exist. And so the necessary and proper clause to the Constitution allows for Congress to carry out implied powers. That is, just because the Constitution doesn't say that they should do this, it doesn't mean they can't. The Supreme Court has the final authority to interpret the Constitution. That is, if the Supreme Court interprets separate but equal as a violation of the 14th Amendment, then Jim Crow has been abolished. You know, Brown v. Board had the power of law when it overturned separate but equal and mandated that integration be the new law of our society. And then finally, the president has some rights in interpreting the Constitution, and even the legislative branch has some rights in interpreting the Constitution. For example, Congress may pass a law reflecting their current interpretation of an amendment, and the Supreme Court may rule in on that. You know, for example, the whole travel ban from specific countries. The president issued a travel ban on several specific countries, saying people from those countries may not enter the United States. And the Supreme Court had to rule on it. That was the president's interpretation of the Constitution. The Supreme Court ruled differently. And then finally, changes have been made to the Constitution through customs that have developed over the years, meaning our way of doing things. And this ability to amend the Constitution is both essential to its functions, but also it is necessary. Talking about Chapter 3, Section 4. And the big idea is that the Constitution reflects the values and the goals of the society that creates it. And so some of the terms you'll see today, like popular sovereignty, like rule of law, separation of powers, checks and balances, the complicated functionings of our government, and hopefully we'll get into some of the purpose thereof. And so, you know, when we think about the specific roles of each branch of the government, each one has specific powers, specific responsibilities. And these are all outlined in the Constitution, of course. So the Constitution establishes the basic principles of the government of the United States. There are five fundamental principles, in fact. Number one, popular sovereignty. The idea that if we are going to try to represent the best interest of people, we got to figure out what people want. And if the people have that power in making decisions, true, real power, well, then we call that popular sovereignty, the rule of the majority. But we also believe in the rule of law. No matter how much you dislike a leader, they have the same rights to legal counsel, the same privileges of a jury of their peers, and of a trial within a court of law. Because after all, we all want justice until we need mercy. And that's just human nature. And our society is built on that idea. But we also believe in the separation of powers. That is the split of authority among these three branches of government. And admittedly, that complicates matters. If you want a four-day school week, it could take 3 years to get that idea passed. Just in Henderson County. Not to mention at the state level, it could take a decade. At the national level, it might have been going on since the 60s. Things take a very long time. You know, we were talking about universal health care. Presidents have been trying to get that passed since Harry Truman. And so it might continue through the rest of our lives. And our kids might someday enjoy that, but that's how long it can take to get things done. It took 70 years for women to get the right to vote. We also believe in checks and balances. Checks and balances meaning that the president can be limited if he declares an executive order that violates the Constitution or federal law. The legislative branch can also limit the president, and the president can also act unilaterally when necessary. So he has checks and powers over the other branches as well. And these are all based around the ideas of federalism, which you guys have been creating your ads about. What federalism is and why it should be implemented in our country. It is namely the balance of power between states and the federal government. But there have been changes in the meaning of republic over time. You know, when Plato wrote the book, The Republic, the idea was that those who owned land, those who had wealth, those who were male, those who were free, those who were citizens were the only ones intellectually capable of representing the interests of their people. That was the prevailing idea of democracy at his time. And it's obviously evolved. In 1828, you didn't have to own property anymore. In 1865, you didn't have to be white anymore. In 1920, you didn't have to be male anymore. In post-Vietnam, you didn't have to be 21. And so who represents us? Well, it's still not everyone, right? You guys don't get to vote. And so we're still not in a full rep. We don't let babies vote. I love Avery, but he's not picking our next president. And he may never. And he probably shouldn't ever. He's a baby. We should work on talking first. And so, you know, what does representation mean? Well, that idea has evolved once more. Let's unpack some of these. First, popular sovereignty. This is the notion that the power lies with the people. Popular as in what do the people want? Sovereignty as in the power. You know, it was once believed that God chose rulers, and he did so through the bloodlines, and that God placed that ruler there to punish evildoers and reward good behavior. John Locke said, no, the government derives its power from the consent of the governed, and we based our civilization on that. So the power lies with the people. And this is ensured through the election process. Theoretically, anyone could run for president. Now, to get the national attention, it requires a considerable degree of resources, but theoretically, anyone can do it. It tends to come down to the two major parties because they represent the largest coalitions, ergo the most people and the most money. But once more, if Alyssa felt so led, she could run for president. There's only a handful of stipulations. She's got to be in her 30s. She has to have been born here. Not convicted of a felony. Handful of simple things. We believe in the rule of law. And that is the principle that the law applies to everyone. And I get that this Mueller investigation, and I get that the proceedings are taking a very long time. You know, the argument for vigilante justice has always been that it's quicker. However, the inherent problem in vigilante justice is that it makes mistakes. You know, if you rush in, grab someone, and hang them without proper proceedings, they might be innocent. And every now and then, someone goes to prison and languishes in prison, though they are innocent, and it is not proven until much later. So if we make mistakes, as slow as our process is, then we need to be extremely careful. So rule of law means that the power of government is limited. Limited. The amendments guarantee your protections from the government. This applies to everyone, especially the government. You have the right to remain silent if you are arrested. No one can relinquish you of that right. Ever. You can never be compelled to speak. You can't ever be compelled to provide testimony against yourself. No one can. And then finally, the separation of powers. Separation of powers means the split of authority between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches of government. We do believe in the importance of having an executive. You know, if the North Koreans do drop in, we believe that it is important that someone can assume emergency powers and direct our defense. Or if we have a crisis, if a tsunami hits the southeast and wipes it out, there's going to need to be a lot of resources directed quickly and efficiently from one branch. And that's why we have an executive. But at the same time, since we have a rule of law, and those laws are made from representatives whom we elect, the idea there of this separation of powers is that it should be as fair as possible. And finally, balances. Checks and balances means that it is a system in which each branch of government is able to check the power of the other. sometimes the presidential elections can feel like a popularity contest. And it can be disconcerting when you think that some of the most important decisions that affect us are made by the person that was able to garner the most attention. And so it's to our advantage that we have an entire branch of government that operates outside of the political process. The Supreme Court doesn't care if you know their names. They don't. In fact, many of them try to stay out of the news. Why? Because they don't need your vote. Once they're appointed for life. They can be impeached, but it's never been done to my knowledge. Not at the federal level. Some states have impeached justices, sure, but to my knowledge, it's never been done at the federal level. They either die in their position, in fact, they often die in their positions, or they retire. And so their whole purpose is to stay outside of the political process and to make sure that these crazy politicians don't do anything that breaches the rules. Congress has the authority to pass laws. But what if a number of states gang up and pass a law that benefits only that section of states? Well, that law can be vetoed. And maybe it should be. Because if the president vetoes it, 2/3 of the states then have to agree, instead of just a simple majority. And so all of these principles we've talked about today, like checks and balances, popular sovereignty, rule of law, and separation, are very important. But let's get into the principle of federalism. Now, the Constitution establishes a system called federalism. This means that power is divided between the national and the state governments. You are unlikely to have dealings with representatives of your national government. It's funny, we know the big ones. We all know who our president is. Many of you guys know who the Speaker of the House is. But it's sad to think that so many people don't know who our local representatives are. You know, Cody Henson is your state representative. Get to know him. He's a nice guy. We don't agree on everything, but he has to listen to what I have to say because he's my representative. I follow him on social media. Sometimes I comment on his stuff and he replies back. He has to. He's my representative. I've certainly emailed him, called his office. Nice guy. You know, he's someone you need to know. He's your closest connection to the laws that are made in our state. You also need to know our county commissioners. They make decisions that affect Henderson County. And you certainly need to know our superintendent, Mr. Caldwell. Our school board will have representatives from them come in. And once more, we all know the national. Everybody knows Trump. But you'll probably never meet him. And he'll never know your name. And that's probably for the best. I mean, sure, you might meet a president someday, but it's unlikely. But you should meet your local people, and they have an obligation to meet. Now, there are three types of government power. There are express powers. These are powers that Congress specifically has because of the Constitution, specifically granted to the national government. You know, Congress has the authority to pass laws. That is an express power because the Constitution says Congress passes laws. There are the reserved powers. And this is where the 10th Amendment comes in. The reserved powers are the powers that the Constitution does not specifically give to the national government, and then it's up to the states. So in the 10th Amendment it says, oh, and by the way, if we didn't list it in here, it's up to your state. Those are called reserve powers. If the state of North Carolina wants to allow gambling, that's their prerogative. If they want to create a universal health care system. Boston essentially has one. That's their prerogative. If they want to offer free tuition for college universities, Tennessee has that for 2 years. All young people in Tennessee may attend college for 2 years for free. They don't have early colleges. Everybody gets to go. It's not that far from us. That's a huge change, right? That's a big difference from us. That's their prerogative. And then finally, there are concurrent powers. These are powers exercised by the state and federal governments. Law enforcement, for example. You know, if a federal crime were committed in Henderson County, and it happens, like let's say, what was it, about a year ago, the guy was on the loose in Piscataforest. He had murdered someone. He was being hunted by the police. He got out of the forest near Mills River, killed someone, took their truck. He was on the run. Had fled multiple counties. Transylvania was chasing him. Henderson was chasing him. He was finally caught in McDowell. Was eventually found in McDowell County. That was a major manhunt. Multiple counties collaborating. I'm sure the feds were involved. The FBI may have sent representatives. And once more, that is a concurrent power in regards to law enforcement, particularly if you had crossed state lines. Now, the Supremacy Clause establishes that the Constitution is the highest law in the land. Henderson County has an awful lot of freedom when you think about it. We can make a number of rules that pertain particular to us. And we don't always have to go with what the state or the national government wants. But there's a major caveat there. We cannot violate the Constitution. North Carolina cannot violate the Constitution. For example, in the era of Jim Crow, the 15th Amendment required that all people be able to vote regardless of race. Some states threatened to annul that law, saying we're just not going to follow it. Federal troops were placed in those states. Then states like Mississippi said, well, we're just going to pass poll taxes, same in North Carolina. Or, well, we're going to pass a literacy test that only black people have to take. These were seen as loopholes, which were then removed with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Once more, the Constitution proved durable in that North Carolina's unwillingness to follow it didn't make it go away. But it also proved adaptable. And that it can be changed, like the 19th Amendment, to meet the needs of a population.